and he had also published an account of what he alleged to be Napoleonic views, des idées napoléoniennes, in which he jumbled up socialism, socialistic reform, and pacifism with the Napoleonic legend. The Republic of 1848 was soon in difficulties with crude labor experiments, and in October he was able to re-enter the country and stand for election as president. He took an oath as president to be faithful to the Democratic Republic and to regard as enemies all who attempted to change the form of government. In 2 years' time, in December 1852, he was Emperor of the French. At first he was regarded with considerable suspicion by Queen Victoria, or rather by Baron Stockmar, the friend and servant of King Leopold of Belgium, and the keeper of the international conscience of the British Queen and her consort. All this group of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha people had a reasonable and generous enthusiasm for the unity and well-being of Germany upon liberal lines, and they were disposed to be alarmed at this Bonapartist revival. Lord Palmerston, the British Foreign Minister, was, on the other hand, friendly with a usurper from the outset. He offended the Queen by sending amiable dispatches to the French President without submitting them for her examination, and so giving her sufficient time to consult Stockmar upon them, and he was obliged to resign. But subsequently the British court veered round to a more cordial attitude to the new adventurer. The opening years of his reign promised a liberal monarchy rather than a Napoleonic career, a government of cheap bread, great public works, and holidays, and he expressed himself warmly in favour of the idea of nationalism, which was naturally a very acceptable idea to any liberal German intelligence. There had been a brief all-German parliament at Frankfurt in 1848, which was overthrown in 1849 by the Prussian monarchy. Before 1848, all the great European courts of the Vienna settlement had been kept in a kind of alliance by the fear of a second and more universal democratic revolution. After the revolutionary failures of 1848, this fear was lifted, and they were free to resume the scheming and counter-scheming of the days before 1789, with the vastly more powerful armies and fleets the first Napoleonic phase had given them. The game of great powers was resumed, with zest, after an interval of 60 years, and it continued until it produced the catastrophe of 1914. The Tsar of Russia, Nicholas I, was the first to move towards war. He resumed the traditional thrust of Peter the Great towards Constantinople. Nicholas invented the phrase of the sick man of Europe for the Sultan, and finding an excuse in the misgovernment of the Christian population of the Turkish Empire, he occupied the Danubian principalities in 1853. European diplomatists found themselves with a question of quite the 18th-century pattern. The designs of Russia were understood to clash with the designs of France in Syria, and to threaten the Mediterranean route to India of Great Britain, and the outcome was an alliance of France and England to bolster up Turkey, and a war, the Crimean War, which ended in the repulse of Russia. One might have thought that the restraint of Russia was rather the business of Austria and Germany, but the passion of the foreign offices of France and England for burning their fingers in Russian affairs has always been very difficult to control. The next phase of interest in this revival of the great power drama was the exploitation by the Emperor Napoleon III and the King of the small kingdom of Sardinia in North Italy of the inconveniences and miseries of the divided state of Italy, and particularly of the Austrian rule in the north. The King of Sardinia, Victor Emmanuel, made an old-time bargain for Napoleon's help in return for the provinces of Nice and Savoy. The war between France and Sardinia, on the one hand, and Austria, on the other, broke out in 1859, and was over in a few weeks. The Austrians were badly beaten at Magenta and Solferino. Then, being threatened by Prussia on the Rhine, Napoleon made peace, leaving Sardinia the richer for Lombardy. The next move in the game of Victor Emmanuel and of his chief minister Cavour was an insurrectionary movement in Sicily led by the great Italian patriot Garibaldi. Sicily and Naples were liberated, and all Italy except only Rome, which remained loyal to the Pope, and Venetia, which was held by the Austrians, fell to the King of Sardinia. A general Italian parliament met at Turin in 1861, and Victor Emmanuel became the first King of Italy. But now the interest in this game of European diplomacy shifted to Germany. Already the common sense of the natural political map had asserted itself. In 1848, all Germany, including, of course, German Austria, was for a time united under the Frankfurt Parliament. But that sort of union was particularly offensive to all the German courts and foreign offices. They didn't want a Germany united by the will of its people. They wanted Germany united by legal and diplomatic action, as Italy was being united. In 1848, the German Parliament had insisted that the largely German provinces of Schleswig-Holstein, which had been in the German Bund, must belong to Germany. It had ordered the Prussian army to occupy them, and the King of Prussia had refused to take his orders from the German Parliament, and so had precipitated the downfall of that body. Now the King of Denmark, Christian IX, for no conceivable motive except the natural folly of kings, embarked upon a campaign of annoyance against the Germans in these two duchies. Prussian affairs were then very much in the hands of a minister of the 17th century type, von Bismarck, Count, in 1865, Prince, in 1871, and he saw brilliant opportunities in this trouble. He became the champion of the German nationality in these duchies. It must be remembered that the King of Prussia had refused to undertake this role for democratic Germany in 1848, and he persuaded Austria to side with Prussia in a military intervention. Denmark had no chance against these great powers. She was easily beaten and obliged to relinquish the duchies. Then Bismarck picked a quarrel with Austria for the possession of these two small states. So he brought about a needless and fratricidal war of Germans for the greater glory of Prussia and the ascendancy of the Hohenzollern dynasty in Germany. German writers of a romantic turn of mind represent Bismarck as a great statesman planning the unity of Germany, but indeed he was doing nothing of the kind. The unity of Germany was a reality in 1848. It was and is in the nature of things. The Prussian monarchy was simply delaying the inevitable in order to seem to achieve it in Prussian fashion. That's why, when at last Germany was unified, instead of bearing the likeness of a modern civilized people, it presented itself to the world with the face of this archaic Bismarck, with a fierce moustache, huge jackboots, a spiked helmet, and a sword. In this war between Prussia and Austria, Prussia had for an ally Italy. Most of the smaller German states who dreaded the schemes of Prussia fought on the side of Austria. The reader will naturally want to know why Napoleon III didn't grasp this admirable occasion for statecraft and come into the war to his own advantage. All the rules of the great power game required that he should. But Napoleon, unhappily for himself, had got his fingers in a trap on the other side of the Atlantic, and was in no position to intervene. In order to understand the entanglement of this shifty gentleman, it's necessary to explain that the discord in interests between the northern and southern states of the American Union, due to the economic differences based on slavery, had at last led to open civil war. The federal system, established in 1789, had to fight the secessionist efforts of the confederated slave-holding states.